Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Well, this is our last new show of 2018 on Studio Tulsa. We'll have a series of holiday specials and the best of Studio Tulsa through the new year. And for this last show, we look at some of the traditions of the Christmas holiday. When we think of Christmas, we usually look to the past, according to my guest today. That's what the Victorians were doing when they popularized many of the traditions and ushered in the celebrations that are with us today. Today, we certainly look to the past for our traditions, but many of those traditions were forged in a time when Americans created a Christmas focused on the present and future. It was the mid-century era of the 20th century. Think of our traditional activities we plan our holidays around. Many of those traditions began in the post-war era. That's the view of my guest today, Sarah Archer. She's a writer and curator of design and a contributor to Architectural Digest. She's also written for the Huffington Post, Slate, and the Washington Post. Her 2016 book, Mid-Century Christmas, has just been reissued in a new stocking stuffer edition, and she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Sarah Archer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
In your book, A Mid-Century Christmas, you write that America's way of celebrating Christmas changed profoundly after the Second World War. What happened then?
The best way to describe it would be in sort of one sentence, would say that there was a big pivot from looking backward and celebrating Christmas as a kind of nostalgic exercise and looking at the past to looking forward and kind of fantasizing about the future. That's kind of the real broad strokes summary. And one of the things that fueled this was economic abundance and technology. It was a profound shift in the way Americans lived between 1940 and 1960. The percentage of Americans who owned their own homes jumped almost 20%. So by 1960, almost 62% of Americans owned their homes. And so that meant, this was because of the GI Bill in part, 1944, the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, which helped returning veterans go to grad school or college or start businesses or purchase homes. And developers like William Levitt were building the first Levittowns in places like Long Island and Pennsylvania. There were 1.7 new homes built in 1950. So huge amounts of new homes going up, people owning their homes for the first time, moving out of cities, and needing to buy stuff. They needed dishwashers and refrigerators and stoves and furniture, and suddenly had more space to decorate and had lawns where they could put, you know, newly post-war plastic-safe Christmas lights out on the lawn. So there was this real kind of shift in the material abundance. And the other big thing that happened was, between the Victorian era and the post-war era, Christmas as we know it, that kind of Charles Dickens, Victorian, old-fashioned Christmas, was an exercise of nostalgia even in the Victorian era. There's a wonderful drawing by the illustrator Thomas Nast from 1866 that depicts Santa Claus in his workshop, and this is kind of like one of the earliest depictions of Santa Claus in the famous workshop, which you see even now, like in movies like Elf, they have, you know, the elves are all using like wooden mallets to make these like high-tech toys. That's kind of the joke. It's like, how is Santa Claus making, you know, iPhones out of...
How's he making drones?
Exactly. How is he making high-tech drones? And the funny thing about this is, because 1866, from our point of view, is a long time ago, the kind of medieval imagery and the Victorian imagery all gets kind of blended together. It all just seems kind of old and old-fashioned. But this was old-fashioned in their time, too. This was sort of the height of the Industrial Revolution. 1866 was the year that the Intercontinental Railroad was completed and the first telegraph wires were laid. The periodic table was discovered. You know, there was a lot going on in urbanization, industrialization, and the American landscape being transformed, and in Great Britain. We followed along a little bit later. So movements like the Gothic Revival and the Arts and Crafts Movement, where thinkers like John Ruskin and William Morris were valorizing the medieval craftsman as this kind of pure emblem of, you know, honest work and somebody who doesn't mass produce things and doesn't use shoddy materials, but really sort of, you know, uses honest labor and real materials and real craft, gets kind of transposed onto Santa Claus. So Santa Claus is depicted in this kind of medieval workshop using carpenter's tools to make toys, and he has this ledger book, the kind of, you know, good versus bad, you know, good versus naughty ledger book to kind of keep track of who's who. As a way of kind of lifting a little bit of a veil over the machinery of modern retail, right? It was sort of like, we know that we're shopping at department stores and, you know, ordering things from catalogs, but we're going to kind of disguise that a little bit by sort of fantasizing about this kindly old man who's, you know, making things by hand. So all of that kind of backward-looking stuff made Christmas an exercise almost in kind of looking back to the Middle Ages, between roughly the 1840s and the 1930s.
And so by the 1940s, this is sort of a meme that's, it was antiquated in the 1860s, and now it's exactly. 80 years later. It's also, I think you can't underestimate the pent-up demand in America, because first you had the Depression, then the war.
Absolutely.
Both were times of privation. The reason housing exploded was because there was nowhere near enough housing.
There was literally not enough housing, and there was pent-up, frantic desire to just buy stuff and have something new for a change. I mean, this is like 16 years from the Depression through the end of World War II. And, you know, to not have, I mean, if you remember it or have family who remember it, I remember hearing as a kid, I have my mother's older sister who was a child during the war and remembered it. There was this kind of mantra almost of like, after the war, when the war is over, we can go here, we can do that, we can have X, Y, or Z. This kind of just feeling of like, like when is this going to end? And so people, I think, just sort of went like a little nuts at the end. You know, it was like, finally, we can like actually decorate and have fun. And goods became very cheap. There were lots of post-war infrastructure left over for things like making aluminum or making plastic. Tupperware was a byproduct of the war because polyethylene was refined to protect wire cables. And then DuPont was sort of like, okay, what can we do with this? The same thing happened with Alcoa Aluminum. They collaborated with the aluminum specialty company, and that's how aluminum trees were born. There were there was a machine that made kind of fringed, very fine strips of aluminum, and faux trees were a way to use that.
So now I had not thought of that. I have to admit, I have not thought of that. This idea that the aluminum tree came from pent-up war production, and we had to put it into the consumer market. Yeah.
No, and because aluminum was a big, big deal in that time period. It was sort of, I mean, we think of it, I think nowadays, I don't mean to offend any aluminum people out there, but, you know, we don't think of it as kind of like the greatest thing since sliced bread. But in the post-war period, even during the Depression, it was sometimes referred to as poor man's silver, because you can kind of brush it and polish it in a way that looks pretty snazzy. And if you want, you know, a new poppy set or what have you, you know, it looks pretty nice when it's first out of the box, and you can take good care of it. And there were lots of ways in which aluminum was used for household goods, coffee pots, toasters, tumblers, you name it, all of that stuff in different colors. And this was widely advertised. There's a great ad, actually, series of ads from Reynolds from the early 1960s that have aluminum trees side by side with kind of aluminum gift ideas. Toasters and different things for the kitchen. The kind of, these are all the ways you can celebrate the holiday with aluminum.
I was really struck in the book by how you made this contrast between the Victorian period and this post-war, mid-century period. And I always think of the Victorian period as also a time when Christmas traditions changed greatly. You know, the Christmas tree came in the Victorian age.
Absolutely.
All sorts of things. I think actually greeting cards actually had its roots in the charitable trends of the time began in the Victorian period. Had those traditions stayed with Americans all the way till the mid-century period?
My research suggests that there was, you know, it's to paraphrase, what is it, the Hemingway's way of describing going bankrupt, like gradually then all at once. There were kind of traces of high-tech Santa Claus. In, you know, there's a wonderful card that I found from the 1930s that shows him on a wireless. Like there's a kind of a little bit of a transitional period during the Art Deco period time. And all of those things, like industrialization itself, the United States was like 20 or 30 years behind Great Britain. The guy who invented Christmas cards as we know them was Henry Cole, who was an industrialist who, with Prince Albert, founded the Victoria and Albert Museum and was big on design and promoting ways of popularizing British craft and design. So Christmas cards were kind of one way to sort of support artisans. And so there was this notion that you're kind of like sharing something aesthetic and lovely, but you're also kind of keeping British illustrators, you know, in ink, I guess. And Prang founded the first big Christmas card company here in America. And the funny thing is, before this period, really before the 1830s or so, Christmas was almost not celebrated. Which sounds so weird because of this old-fashioned imagery. We have this notion that it goes back forever, you know, that it dates back, you know, thousands of years. But in fact, it was sort of, if it was celebrated at all, it tended to be a kind of grown-up, like, bacchanal. It was sort of, people were kind of drinking and carousing, sort of like New Year's Eve now. it was banned in the colonies because the Puritans hated it and thought that it was, you know, just a disgrace, and it was, you know, drinking and carousing on a religious holiday, and it was terrible. And so it was effectively rebranded by people like Charles Dickens and like Washington Irving in New York City as a holiday for children that revolved around gift giving and wholesomeness and kind of keeping the kids indoors where you can keep an eye on them because everything's under the tree. And it's, you know, a reason to support retail. So it's, the funny thing is that we have this notion every year somebody will say, it used to be so much less commercial. It, you know, I remember when it was less commercial. And it was never less commercial because the holiday that we know never existed without a connection to retail. Like that just, it didn't exist. So it's funny, the way people react to Christmas and kind of remember it or sort of remember it in a certain way is really, it tells you a lot really about how they're feeling about now, I think, rather than, you know, feeling about then.
Yeah. My guest today is Sarah Archer. She is a writer and curator and a contributor to Architectural Digest. She is the author of Mid-Century Christmas, which actually came out in 2016. There's a new stocking stuffer edition this year from Countryman Press, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, before we talk about some of the ideas behind Mid-Century Christmas, I would like to really touch on the connections between the Victorian era and the mid-century era, because there are all these wonderful similarities. The Victorian era had Charles Dickens and Scrooge, this idea that, yes, you need to celebrate Christmas. In mid-century, you have Dr. Seuss's The Grinch, which, again, gets back to this idea of throw away the consumerism, and it's this wholesome, loving holiday of you know, treat your fellow man as you would treat yourself. There's a cult of domesticity in the Victorian age. Mm-hmm. Mid-century also had a similar sort of cult, but this time it was completely based on consumerism.
Yeah, totally different. I mean, they have parallels in that both of these time periods represent big populations undergoing massive, massive economic change and kind of adapting to the social changes that came in the wake of that. And the Victorian era, that sort of cult of domesticity that emerges in the 19th century, is basically a response to the way in which the physical places of work and home split. Because before industrialization and before there were factories and offices on kind of a large scale, lots of people, in fact, most people, if you worked on a farm, if you owned a very small business, even in a city, you probably lived and worked pretty close together. You know, you maybe lived over the store, you lived on the farm. Certainly there were divisions of labor between the sexes, but it wasn't sort of like the 19th century model, which holds that the home, in this kind of vaguely religious, patriotic sense, is the place where we keep the family pure, and we teach children, and women are entrusted with this amazing responsibility of teaching kids, and men go out and kind of deal with all the grubby things like politics and business and making money to support the family, and those two places are separate. They don't mix, and that the home is a sanctuary, and that, you know, the cozy fireplace and the food and lovely smells and kind of presents, all of that stuff of 19th century Victorian Christmas is bound up in that. And something kind of similar happened in World War II. After the GIs came home, there was a real firm, you know, like, now is the time for you to get off the assembly line and get back into the house because men need jobs.
Gender
that,
roles.
It was kind of like not voluntary, you know.
Yeah, right. This was gender roles and gender discipline in a way. It was, let's reinforce this idea that, you know,
definitely,
women who have been in the workforce when men were in the war, now it's like, you go home, you set up a household, we will go back to work. Yes, it's not the greatest message.
Purchasing power is patriotic because, of course, our big adversary now in the 1950s is the Soviet Union. And the reason that we have to oppose them is theoretically because they're communist. So we all have to own our homes and buy stuff and work hard and generate income and sort of all those things. And so it's kind of this like gender role, but also a real political act in a way to kind of say, you know, you see this all, it's funny, my next book is actually about the Cold War kitchen, so I have kitchen appliances very much on the brain. But, you know, at World's Fair, like, there was this amazing exchange between Richard Nixon and Nikita Khrushchev about the modern American kitchen when it was displayed at the American Exposition in Moscow in 1959. And Nixon is kind of like talking about how great all the new gadgets are and how it makes life easier for women. And Khrushchev says, like, well, we don't enslave our women. And he sort of has this kind of like, in a weird way, sort of feminist reaction to it. Like, I doubt he would have described himself that way. But, you know, like, who says women have to do all of this? Like, you know, it's this real kind of using technology to enforce those roles and to kind of promote this way of life as superior and better to our political adversaries. So both periods, yeah, I mean, the Victorian era and the Atomic Age, also like the Scrooge versus Grinch parallel, is super interesting to contrast because it tells you so much about the differences between the two time periods. The Dickens story, and Charles Dickens actually spent time in a workhouse as a child or as a young man. He had a pretty tough upbringing in England and was very concerned about poverty and child labor and, you know, inequality, as we now call it. So his message really is about material abundance. You know, don't hoard food and things. You have to share. You know, if you're one of the haves, you have to share with the have-nots. And Dr. Seuss is sort of writing, you know, a century later, give or take 10 years, you know, that essentially now, like, so many of us are the haves. In post-war America, we're kind of on a buying frenzy that, you know, don't lose the message of Dickens' Christmas Carol in your race to kind of acquire all this stuff. Like, that's really not what it's about. So it's kind of, it's a different twist on that same message.
Well, the book is filled with these wonderful illustrations and pictures from the era. And, you know, you were talking about the Cold War figuring into mid-century Christmas. It's very apparent from the toys of the era, both in the Soviet Union and in America. I mean, there's, you know, Grandfather Frost riding a missile.
Isn't that wild? I was so blown away by finding, I discovered those in an article, I think on Boing Boing a couple years ago. And that actually is one of the things that got me interested in this topic, because I was so astonished by, you know, having grown up with a kind of old-fashioned-ish Christmas myself in the 80s, like I had kind of missed all of this Atomic Age stuff. I think probably my parents were like, oh, God, that's, you know, like aluminum trees, like how tacky. But I was, you know, now I have one and I'm like, oh, my God, it's so great. But it's, yeah, I mean, the toys are a microcosm of what was going on in the adult world. You have, you know, easy bake ovens and stoves and little tiny vacuum cleaners and things, you know, a chemistry technician set that's pink for girls, because of course women can't be chemists in their own right. They have to be technicians. Chemistry sets for boys, rockets, you know, anything that has to do with, you know, sort of the space cadet cult of early NASA and, you know, all the sci-fi
or
stuff.
Engineering erector sets of the like, yeah,
totally.
Exactly.
Tiny architect, right, sort of the budding architects of tomorrow. And it's really the earliest period during which toys are extremely gendered, and the use of color is really evident in that. That, like, you know, things for boys are kind of these primary dark colors, and things for girls are usually sort of pale, you know, pale pink, pale blue, which was the same thing that was going on in interior design. You know, sort of the woman's realm of the kitchen, usually kind of a candy color, and, it, you know, really visually demarcating that as a feminine space.
There's also a wonderful section on just how mid-century helped develop the Christmas we know today of lights, ornaments, all the sort of accoutrements of a Christmas holiday. A lot of these really became popular and got their start right after the war.
Yes, and they are often like rooted in things that were popular ahead of time or before that. Many of them have pre-war sort of analogs, like Christmas balls, the sort of glass ornaments that were popularized in mostly in the 1920s by Woolworth. They came from Germany. They were produced by a man named Max Eckhart, who came from the part of Germany where there was a lot of glass blowing going back many centuries. And he eventually teamed up with Corning in New York State, the company that makes Pyrex and all the rest of it. And they had a machine that was referred to as a ribbon machine that was designed to produce light bulbs. And they adapted this technology to produce Christmas bulbs, the little spherical ornaments. So those really represent the tradition of using real fruit on trees, which I hadn't realized actually until I started researching this. But there was this long tradition, and people still do this in parts of Eastern Europe, I gather, hanging things like apples and oranges from the tree to sort of represent, you know, new life on the coldest day of the year. And, you know, the same thing is true of Christmas lights. People used to use real candles, and which obviously is not a great idea for safety reasons. And Christmas lights themselves actually they were first invented by Thomas Edison in 1879, and they made their debut at the White House with Grover Cleveland in office, I believe, in 1895. Didn't really become popular or affordable until the 20s at the earliest. And at that time, you're more likely to see them. They were sort of coated in, they would have like a fabric casing. It was a real sort of old school technology. After the war, polyethylene plastic was used, and so they were much safer and much more flexible. So it's that 1950s, 60s, you start to see like the General Electric decorating guides that tell you how to turn your lawn into a lightscape and, you know, do interesting things with your tree inside.
Now, there was a whole set of the design element of this period, and I never heard this term before, Googie style of design.
Googie and this, architecture.
And this
right,
is
not
really
to be confused with Google.
Yes, exactly. But this sort of symbolized this idea of what was then 50s high-tech space-age design, Jetsons and everything like that. And I never knew this term, Googie. This is the style of design.
It was, and it has a funny story. It was actually named after a diner in California, and it was an architect, Mr. Lautner, had designed it, and somebody, an editor from House and Home magazine, driving by and thought it was really cool, and he sort of knew that the diner was called Googie. It was named after the owner's wife, I believe. That was a nickname. So that just kind of stuck among architecture aficionados in that time period. And it's useful to think of it as kind of the next step in, if you're familiar with streamlining.
Yes.
That was sort of the big design element of the 1930s, and it was 1920s and 30s, really. It had this, you know, the look and feel of forward movement, because that was what progress looked like to people in that time period, right? It was trains, cars, you know, things that didn't look like the boxy, you know, Model T, but looked smooth as though they had been designed to kind of fly through the air. So you started to see things like refrigerators and toasters and pencil sharpeners get that smooth look. They don't need to go fast through the air, those things, but they do need to look like they represent progress so that people will want to buy them. So the thing that happened after that is that the next big leap forward was atomic energy, which of course is something that you can't see. So designers started looking at scientific drawings and models to develop a visual shorthand for what progress would look like in the space age. So it's things like if you go to the Apple Genius Bar, you'll see that kind of six-sided, a series of ovals that used to be the symbol of atomic energy, parabolas, you know, big sort of swooping lines that kind of echoed, you know, space flight and, you know, the space flight plans, and gave people the sense that something was futuristic. And then, of course, you start to see it everywhere in the Jetsons and all sorts of different parts of Disneyland that were, you know, designed to teach people about technology in the future. So, it's not a term that people generally know, but it's actually everywhere if you start looking for it.
Right. It's basically a representation of the atom in some way.
Exactly.
Yeah. The book also tells wonderful stories. For example, on Christmas Eve this year and everywhere in the United States, you're going to see weathermen come on with their little graphics showing the radars of Santa on his way. And of course, that all began with NORAD beginning to track Santa Claus during the darkest days of the Cold War, when nuclear annihilation was 30 minutes away. NORAD was
every
Christmas Eve, they would say, "We're following Santa Claus as he leaves the North Pole." Tell us how that began.
I take this story with a grain of salt. I have not been able to 100% verify that this is true, but the legend is that Sears had a print ad that, as so many stores, department stores do, you know, have, you know, like sort of call Santa or visit Santa, an ad that advertised you could, you know, call Santa at this number, 1-800, blah, 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 and, you know, tell him your Christmas wishes, and that there was a misprint which somehow directed people to call NORAD. Which maybe in 1955 this was possible. I think it would be a little trickier than that nowadays to get in touch with the Aerospace Command. But the story goes that, you know, children were calling in and the people were, you know, answering the phone were totally confused. And that a colonel who was on duty named Harry Shook immediately saw it as an opportunity to kind of, you know, essentially bank some goodwill. Like, that, you know, people are worried about this and they're afraid of it. They don't really understand what it means. You know, this is a chance for us to kind of put a little bit of a warm and fuzzy face on, you know, this part of the military, which is frankly terrifying to people. If you were a kid in that era, you experienced air raid drills, and, you know, all of that was absolutely terrifying. So this tradition started and has pretty much been going ever since. You can now do it online. You can follow on the internet. And to me, it represents, like those space age cards, both from the Soviet Union and the American ones that sort of have Santa Claus depicted in like space, you know, a rocket ship or what have you, this kind of coming together of a couple of different strands of mythology. And there's the nativity story and the Santa Claus narrative, which are totally separate but have become merged in the way we celebrate the holiday. And they both involve the night sky. Like, there's this, you know, beautiful story about the wise men following the star, and there's Santa Claus, you know, flying around the world in his sleigh, and that you kind of look up at the sky and think, you know, where is he? And looking up at the sky was kind of a scary and profound thing for people living in the 50s, because, like, you didn't know what was out there. Satellites and all these things that were suddenly, you know, like if you had grown up before radio had been invented, now suddenly you were living in a world where there were satellites and, you know, who knows what would happen. So I think it was all of this, like, space age stuff vis-a-vis Santa Claus was a way of kind of trying to, in a sense, make peace or kind of come to a detente with this idea of living in the nuclear age. Like, this is normal for us now.
My guest today is Sarah Archer. She's a writer and curator and contributor to Architectural Digest and the author of Mid-Century Christmas, the Stocking Stuffer edition. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. One last question that has to go with film and television. This was a golden age for Christmas programming. You just have to watch television today and you see films from the 1940s and 50s. These are the classics. Yep. Holiday programs. We still watch a Charlie Brown Christmas. We watch the Claymation animation programs each year. You know, we still certainly have Lifetime and Hallmark films today, but they don't compare. They're not the same. What was it about this era?
I grew up watching all that stuff too. That was sort of, I mean, they weren't that old when I was watching it, but I think, yeah, absolutely. It's like the golden age of holiday programming. And I think it's because they capture something of that Christmas Carol spirit that they really did an amazing job of kind of at the height of Cold War abundance and materialism, especially the Charlie Brown Christmas, I think is really like an underrated classic in certain ways in terms of its, I mean, it's obviously cute and it's adorable, but it's also, it's profound. If you watch it as a grown-up, it's really about these children, you know, exploring, you know, there's a whole narrative about a pink aluminum tree and kind of the tackiness of it, and then kind of wanting to nurture this kind of sad, pathetic tree that is, you know, can barely support a single ornament, and kind of looking around and being frustrated, like, what is this all about? Like, why is it all about just buying stuff? Like, who cares? And, you know, it's Linus who ultimately says, well, it's about, you know, peace on earth and goodwill towards men. And that's what they ultimately celebrate at the very end. And I think that never goes out of style. That's, you know, the aesthetics totally change. It's, you know, there's a small population of people who still like aluminum trees. But, you know, all of those, it's not saccharine. It's very, you know, earnest and, you know, and fun at the same time. So it's something that, you know, like a 5-year-old can watch it and get something out of it. And, you know, a 50-year-old can be moved by it. So I think that's one reason why they've stayed so popular.
All right. Well, the name of the book is Mid-Century Christmas. It's a wonderful book full of holiday traditions. Sarah, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Merry Christmas.
Sarah Archer is a writer and independent curator on design and a contributor to Architectural Digest. Her book, Mid-Century Christmas, was originally released in 2016. It's now out in a new stocking stuffer edition. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today, and this is our final new program of 2018. We'll have some holiday specials and the best of Studio Tulsa through the new year. On behalf of my partner in crime and my wonderful editor and producer, Scott Gregory, we wish you a very joyous holiday season, and we thank you so much for listening to Studio Tulsa each weekday. I'm Rich Fisher. Thank you for listening.